Thank you. Good afternoon, Your Honors. I'm Kathy Cooper on behalf of the plaintiff appellant, Major Retired John Davis. My attorney registration number is 15947.
Ms. Cooper, before you launch in, so I don't have to interrupt you, could you explain to me what impact this arbitrator's decision had on anything? I was puzzled, and I kept reading all the briefs to try to figure it out. It seems like both sides seem to admit it's not binding on anybody. I'm just,
correct.
I don't understand that process, and I couldn't figure out what it had to do with. So does it just in terms of, I don't want you to tell me about right now, that's evidence, it shows that there's a reasonable jury could find. I'm just physically curious, is it binding? Or what was the purpose for it?
The purpose of the arbitration was to try and obtain a hearing for Mr. Davis so that he could clear his name. Unfortunately, in the school district context, arbitration is advisory only. So it's not like a teacher dismissal case where the district has to accept the factual findings and then a recommendation is just that, a recommendation. In this case, as in many arbitration cases over the years, Denver Public Schools first objected to the arbitration, then the arbitrator found that we could go forward, and they simply rejected the arbitrator's decision in toto.
But so the answer is it's advisory, and everyone agrees. There's no question that it's just an advisory thing.
That's right.
Okay.
However, as you indicated, Your Honor, at the very beginning of your question, if nothing else, the arbitration demonstrates that different minds can make different determinations on the facts of this case. And since that is one of the standards that applies on appeal, especially for a motion to dismiss, we thought it was very important to incorporate that into the decision. Moreover, the arbitrator spent a great deal of time analyzing the collective bargaining agreement, analyzing the basic fairness and due process, a guide for discipline that the district uses to inform the collective bargaining agreement's provisions on discipline, which are found at Article 11-3. So, because we did notice pleading, as is the case in this jurisdiction, we wanted to demonstrate to the court that this was a complicated issue of contract interpretation. Apparently, we were unsuccessful in that endeavor. I think this case reveals why motions to dismiss are viewed with disfavor, and why contract interpretation should be sensibly applied, or to use Your Honor's test, applied with common sense. The facts are that Major Davis, as you know, is a retired veteran of the United States Army, where he served for 24 years. Following his retirement, he went to work at the Denver Public Schools as a senior Army instructor at Kennedy High School for the Junior Reserve Officer Training Corps program, JROTC. One of the problems of the case is that all JROTC instructors need only have an authorization to teach. They do not have to go through the education coursework, the bachelor's degree, and so on that is required of regular licensed teachers. And because there are relatively few JROTC instructors in the district, somehow their rights got overlooked and lost in between the collective bargaining agreement and the guide for due process. Mr. Major Davis worked for Denver Public Schools for 8 years as the senior Army instructor, and all of his evaluations were positive. Nevertheless, and his he was evaluated both by the district and by his Army supervisor. There was never a question about any of his evaluations. They were exemplary. However, in April of 2009, his principal placed him on administrative leave with pay because the principal told him there had been some allegations of questionable conduct towards female ROTC cadets, and these are openly discussed in that arbitrator's decision. Major Davis was released to return to work after Denver Public Schools' own Office of Risk and Security did a thorough investigation and found that the allegations against him were unfounded. And the recommendation was that he return to work. However, before he was allowed to return to work, his principal alleged that there was another allegation against him, and this time, even though the DPS Office of Security did not make a finding of any bad conduct and did not make any recommendation, this time his principal took the recommendation to the board that he be dismissed.
Ms. Cooper, yes, we are aware of the facts, mm-hmm. and for your benefit, I think it would be good now to talk about the legal issues.
Okay. I think the important thing that I wanted to stress by these facts is that at no time has he ever had a hearing to clear his name. Now, the board terminated Major Davis on August 18th, but made the termination retroactive to July 1st of 2009. This is unprecedented, as far as I know, in the history of DPS, and one might question why. As you're aware, there were two claims for relief. The first claim that's before the court today, and a second claim that alleged that Major Davis wasn't paid his correct wages. In the process of discovery and determining the basis of that claim, we discovered that indeed Major Davis had a continuing contract every year by virtue of the legal regulations of the cadet command from the U.S. Army. So it was Denver Public Schools' obligation to ensure that he had a contract every year, and indeed, he signed a contract on May 1st of 2009 to begin on July 1st of 2009.
Well, let me ask you, Ms. Cooper, my memory, I don't think any of this is in your opening brief. Is that true?
It's not in the opening brief.
I'm sorry, go ahead, please.
All right.
Excuse me.
This is information that we learned after the first claim was dismissed.
So what relevance does it have? I mean, the only issue to us is whether the court properly dismissed that complaint. So I recognize there may be equitable impact or whatever else, but we're bound here by what the complaint said and what the court did, right? What the law is.
Yes, there was a change in the judge at the time, so this wasn't an issue we could raise again. And we felt, or I feel it's important that this court know that Major Davis was actually entitled to due process because of that contract.
Okay, well, let me ask you then, coming back if I can, both of you, I think, both sides cited the statute 2232.110. Does that statute allow, absent any contrary provision in the contract, does that statute allow a termination without cause?
No, that statute is very broad, and it says that only the board can terminate personnel. Now, in a school district, there are all kinds of personnel, classified personnel, licensed personnel, licensed teachers, licensed psychologists, et cetera, et cetera. So the final act, with the exception of classified personnel, who by case law are allowed to be terminated by the superintendent, all other personnel must be terminated by the board. In this case, as you know, the court held that the lack of the word termination in Article 11-3 signified to that court that lesser forms of discipline, letters of warning, reprimands, suspensions, had to have just cause, but because that article did not mention the word termination, the board could terminate anyone at will.
Because, and that's leading to where I was going, but there's the CBA, as I recall, also says that the board reserves to it all powers not altered in the contract, or some language to that effect.
Right.
So, I mean, hypothetically, I know you strongly disagree, and I respect that. The judge said, I'm looking at 11-3-3, it tells you what the corrective actions are that deal with cause. Termination is not included in that. So what I have to look at, I have to look at where the what authority the board otherwise has. That's why I asked my question about the statute. I mean, it seemed, you know, at least one interpretation here is that you get, it's not covered in the agreement, therefore we look at what statutory rights the board has, and the board has the right to terminate. I mean, that seems to be where the court was going.
Yes, but the court took it too far.
Okay.
When the parties entered into the collective bargaining agreement and this basic fairness and due process, they were thinking only about licensed statutory teachers who, you know, are protected by the due process statute, 2263.301 et sec. They didn't think about termination of authorized teachers such as Major Davis. They were, I think, proceeding on the assumption that because the statute covers teachers, and I think the lower court made the same mistake, because the statute covers teachers, then the collective bargaining agreement cannot deal with that issue because that's governed by law. However, the collective bargaining agreement does not say all employees are at will if they aren't covered by the statute, TECTA is what we call it. It leaves that question hanging. So in a case like Major Davis's, where he has 24 years of preparation in order to be an ROTC instructor, he has less rights than a beginning first-year teacher who is licensed by the state. So in putting together the collective bargaining agreement and the guide, the due process guide for discipline, one has to read those two documents together in order to understand that there is no difference, although the lower court held otherwise, there's no difference between corrective action and discipline. And for the court to have said corrective action is one thing and discipline is something not covered by the agreement is simply stretching the idea of discipline out of all common sense. If the collective bargaining agreement provides a lesser provides just cause for lesser forms of discipline, then surely in a case like Major Davis's, the board also intended, and the parties also intended, to provide just cause for the ultimate form of discipline, which is termination. Thank you. I'll reserve the little time I have left for rebuttal.
Thank you.
May I proceed?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, rent case 36623. With me on the brief was Mary Gray, 37876. I represent school district number 1, the city and county of Denver. We're asking that you affirm the district court's ruling in all respects. Major Davis brought two legal issues to your attention. The first issue was whether the district court violated the law of motions to dismiss, essentially, in making his decision by not accepting a conclusory allegation and instead looking at the text of the collective bargaining agreement that the school district attached when it moved to dismiss the case. Davis's claim here, and I think the central legal issue in this case, is whether the collective bargaining agreement at issue covers or requires just cause for his termination. His complaint alleges on page 393 of the record at paragraph 20 that the master agreement, what I think everybody agrees is the collective bargaining agreement at issue, prohibited his termination absent just cause. And like I said, the district, we did not accept that allegation as true, nor were we required to, because the collective bargaining agreement, of course, speaks for itself. We attached it to the motion to dismiss, and the district court looked at that in determining that there was no just cause requirement, which is the second issue. There was no error there. Two cases require that result. The first case cited in our brief was Yadin, which provides that a court may consider a document referred to in but not attached to the complaint without converting the motion to a motion for summary judgment, which is what I think the opening brief asserted the district court should have done. Didn't need to do that. The second case that's instructive is the Stauffer case, which provides that the trial court's not required to accept a legal conclusion or factual claims at variance with the express terms of the documents. Major Davis's argument is that we allege that the agreement required just cause, and the district court had no choice but to accept that. Under Stauffer, that's simply not true. Otherwise, plaintiffs could simply allege any old thing that is at absolute variance with the plaintiffs in a breach of contract, that is absolutely at variance with what the contract says, and ostensibly get a trial, and the law in the state of Colorado does not provide that result. So there was no procedural error by the district court. Getting into the second issue, which is, I think, the more important issue in this case, is whether or not this collective bargaining agreement prohibited termination absent just cause. Of course, in a claim for breach of contract involving, or where a breach of a collective bargaining agreement is alleged, the central thing that the trial court does, the first thing that a trial court does, I think, is look at the collective bargaining agreement to determine whether it covers the situation at bar. In this case, the district court did that and determined that it didn't and dismissed the claim. Now, it's pretty much undisputed. I think it actually is undisputed that the agreement itself does not cover termination. As Judge Gabriel pointed out, Article 3-3, and that's at page 241 of the record, Your Honors, addresses corrective action. And this is the only provision in the collective bargaining agreement that references just cause, references letters of warning and reprimand and suspensions without pay. Now, these are the only corrective actions requiring just cause. And contracts have to be enforced, of course, according to their plain meaning and the intention of the words employed. Major Davis is asked the district court and is asking this court to rewrite the contract to include something that is not in it. That simple term is not at all ambiguous and not susceptible to more than one term.
Well, can I ask you a question, Mr. Case? What if, I mean, would you agree that I understand your argument, the contract's attached, so we can look at it on a motion to dismiss. Contract interpretation, even at this stage, would allow de novo review, correct?
Correct.
All right, so we can look at it, and I think you did agree. Contract interpretation is a question of law, but if there's ambiguity, the intent of the parties is a question of fact.
Correct.
So if there's ambiguity, would you agree that, were we hypothetically to find ambiguity, that we would have to reverse here? Because that would be, you end up with fact questions.
Well, and you're asking me to assume that there is ambiguity
with
which
purpose of that question, correct.
I think you're right, Your Honor.
All right. So my question, I fully understand your argument. The only provision that we see that anyone cited to us that uses the word just cause is, 11-3-3. Why does that necessarily defeat the possibility, why could we not, or could not a reasonable juror here conclude that the contract is silent and there's some ambiguity what's required for termination.
Well,
And let me give you an example, and I think this you all may have cited cases that say where an agreement is silent on a matter that you would expect to see in the agreement, with that could create ambiguity. The Supreme Court has said that. Our Supreme Court said that. And, you know, I have, I'll stop talking here in a second, let you respond. I have some concerns. I mean, this really does, your position makes this an at-will contract for everybody. And that's a pretty big step for us to assume as a matter of law. Now, maybe you can help me with that, but I'm troubled. I mean, this is a big step to say this 100-odd page document is basically creates contracts at will for everybody subject to it. It just seems to me if that was the intent, it would have said that. So I'll shut up and listen now.
Okay, Your Honor. Well, I can directly address that. First Please. Of all, part of my answer has to do with something that you raised during Major Davis's argument, which was, what about this clause in the collective bargaining agreement that says all lawful rights and authority of the board not modified by the agreement are retained by the board? That is really a full answer to your question right there, is that and you asked Ms. Cooper about what the statute says about termination. Indeed, it says nothing, it does not require that any cause be approved for termination. It's inarguable that statute allows the board to terminate and to terminate employees at will unless they're otherwise restricted. So the collective bargaining agreement plainly provides that. Something else I'd like to address in Ms. Cooper's argument is that she says that she seems to suggest that JROTC instructors were, because there are so few of them, they were forgotten and maybe there was some sort of mistake here. Well, that can't be true, Your Honor, because if you take this wasn't in my brief because I think it was kind of raised during oral argument, but if you take a look at page 210 of the record in Article 3-1, that lists a number of non-licensed teachers that are subject to the agreement. It's not just JROTC instructors. We have nurses, social workers, therapists, psychologists, counselors, speech-language instructors, educational audiologists. These are all folks who typically do not have teacher's licenses and therefore are not covered by TECTA. I could spin that, assuming that's a point that the association would make, I would spin that right back around to them and to say, you've got 7 or 8 classes of employees that are not subject to the TECTA, Teacher Employment Compensation and Dismissal Act. It was absolutely intended that there be no restrictions on their termination, because if there were intended to be restrictions, they would be in this agreement. Again, because of Article 2-7, which says that all lawful rights and authority are retained by the board, there has been no authority cited by Major Davis that says, other than what we're dealing with here, that says that the district needed any kind of cause for his termination. So
why do you need the provision in 11-3-3? Why do you care if there's just cause for, if you got a problem with an employee, you can just fire him or her? I suppose I'm asking you to respond to Ms. Cooper's argument that, does it make any sense, or does it at least not create ambiguity when you need just cause for these lesser forms of discipline, but you can fire somebody at will?
Well,
why would you need it? Why don't you just fire somebody?
Well, first of all, it is definitely reasonable to think that management could be willing to bargain on certain things, but not certain other things. So, for example, we're willing to bargain about whether or not you get a letter of reprimand or a letter of warning. And I think you're asking me to make arguments about things that aren't necessarily in the record, but I can imagine certain things, for example, pay raises, the promotions, things, whether somebody should get demoted, for example. I mean, these are all things that could go in a person's record and that the employee might have a problem that could adversely affect the employee. And the district, in making this collective bargaining agreement, this thick collective bargaining agreement said, okay, look, we're willing to deal with you there, but if we want to terminate you, it's still our right to do that. We're not giving up that right in this collective bargaining agreement.
We are talking about forms of discipline. Does the guide use the term discipline?
It does use the term discipline, and that was an argument made by the plaintiff, but or made by Major Davis. But Your Honor, that argument sort of it never goes anywhere because for a couple of reasons. First of all, at the very beginning of that guide on page 162, it says, the purpose of this document is to be a resource to assist administrators in effectively managing matters pertaining to corrective actions covered by the agreement. So that, of course, is the phrase
that would be the 1133 provision.
Yes, Your Honor. And so meaning that unless you are talking about giving a corrective action defined under the agreement, you do not use the guide. So the guide doesn't stand for anything other than the process that the district committed to that it would follow when giving an employee a letter of reprimand, a letter of warning, or suspension without pay. It has nothing to do with termination. Now, another clause that Ms. Cooper pointed out in her briefs is something that is in the, I think it's in paragraph 4D of the guide that says something to the effect of the discipline will be determined by the district, ... and must meet a just cause standard. And her argument is that, well, termination must be discipline, right? And it says right here in this agreement that termination is, or that discipline requires just cause. Well, what the district court, she made that argument to the district court. The district court looked at that and said, no, I find that that's in a paragraph, first of all, it's in a paragraph discussing the letter of warning. And, that's another paragraph. But the district court looked at that and determined it's just talking about corrective action under the agreement. And to the extent any of you are troubled by that, think that that creates ambiguity, there's yet more language in the guide that prevents that argument from being made, because the sentence that says, and it's at the very beginning again on page 162 of the record, in the event of a conflict between the terms of the agreement and this guide, the agreement's terms take precedence. So what Ms. Cooper is indicating is that that language, she indicated in her briefs at least, is that that language in the guide basically created a conflict with the agreement, and that should, and that means there was ambiguity there. But the very guide itself says that to prevent that ambiguity, if there is ever perceived to be any conflict between the guide and the agreement controls. So you can't use the guide to say, well, the guide says that you have to have just cause termination for everybody, or that any kind of discipline must be supported by just cause, because the agreement doesn't say that. That's a conflict. So the guide, the basic fairness document, is of no help to Major Davis in trying to create some ambiguity where there is none, Your Honor. The last thing I want to address is this notion of the cadet command regulations. First of all, I think that was basically addressed in the reply brief, so the court need not address this if it doesn't want to. But it's sort of questionable as to whether those regulations really have the force of law, looking at what they are. I think the Major Davis is saying in those regulations, it says that the JROTC instructors must be treated in the same way as other teachers. For example, they must be able up for consideration for Teacher of the Year, and then there's a couple of things like that, and then there's an et cetera at the end. And I think that Major Davis is using that et cetera to say that that means that JROTC instructors somehow have to be treated just the same as teachers. Well, I'll submit to you that even if that argument flied, they are treated, JROTC instructors are treated the same way as teachers under the collective bargaining agreement that do not have a license, because that's what Major Davis was. He was considered a teacher under this collective bargaining agreement, but like a counselor, psychologist, nurse, etc., didn't have a license, doesn't have the protections of TECTA, and pursuant to 2232.110, is basically an at-will employee. I see my time has expired. Unless there are any more questions, I'll have a seat.
Thank you, Mr. Case. Ms. Cooper.
Thank you, Your Honor. The due process document, Basic Fairness and Due Process, a Guide to Discipline, is incorporated into Article 11-3. Therefore, it is already a part of the agreement. It doesn't mean nothing, as opposing counsel would suggest, but all of the information in that document is to be used to inform Article 11-3. The notion that the agreement takes precedent is therefore useless, because that document is a part of the agreement itself. Are there any other questions? I'm flashing over here. Oh, I have 17 seconds.
No, it's going out now.
Oh, it's going out. All right. I appreciate your hearing today. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.